Hey, got the morning show with Aaron. That's King Stingray there with Looper. And in the studio, I've got John Lawson. Morning, John.
Good morning. Sun shining evening.
It is. And where are the Raglan Ramblers going tomorrow? This morning, I didn't want to, not what I planned to talk about, but it just came out of my mouth.
Yep.
To Kaha.
As far as I know, depending on the weather and the wind and the rain and everything, the Raglan Ramblers are going rambling on the other side of the harbour, so taking a boat across from the jetty down the bottom of Bow Street and going across to the beach and walking along the beach and probably over the hill.
I was right when I said Takaha. That was, is that what it said?
Yes.
Yeah, yep. So where is Takaha exactly over the other side of the inlet?
I think it's also got the alternative name of Mussel Rock, so that's maybe the name that most people remember.
Okay.
It's a chunk of basalt that's part of a line of basalt dike that stretches, well, it marks pretty much the north side of the harbour, because the harbour has slipped down in between several faults, and that's the northern fault that it slipped down between. And in that fault line, there's quite a number of places where basalt comes out, and Takaha Point is one of them.
So can we see it from here? Well, not right from here, not from our studio.
I think you can actually see the trig point from where I'm sitting.
Oh, okay. All right, so it is just the other side. Okay.
So the aim is to get up to that trig point tomorrow.
Well, it's appropriate we're talking a little bit about the environment, because the Waikato Regional Council has put out their State of the Environment. What does it say, 2022? Have they spent 6 months crunching data, John?
Lots of these reports come out a year or two after the actual dates they relate to, so I'm not sure what the detail of that is, but yeah, presumably they spend some time collating it all and putting it into a report and rewriting it and saying, oh, we ought to miss that bit out and maybe we ought to emphasize that bit.
Okay, so it kind of doesn't matter, because they're talking about the last 20 years at least, or longer actually, looking at the dates in there. And the first thing it says, is this just a summary that you've put together? Or?
Yeah, the whole document's quite a lengthy document, so I just picked out the bits that seem particularly relevant to us here.
All right, the first one is the proportion of fenced bank length of waterways and pastoral land increased from 28% to 61% between 2002 and 2017. That's good. However, the amount of woody riparian vegetation did not change significantly over the same time frame. So they've fenced off the waterways, good. What's woody riparian vegetation? So they fenced off stuff but nothing grew? Is that what you're saying? No, not nothing.
Sometimes it's only fenced off and it's only grass that grows. It depends how wide the fencing is, the riparian strip, the strip alongside the stream or river.
Actually, there's a farm on the way up to Extreme that's like that, where they've put, and Fred Litchbuck from Harbour Care has been very scathing about it. They did the bare minimum. They had to put a fence in, so they did.
And, yep. Yeah, well, the regional council introduced rules about 20 years ago saying that cattle shouldn't be in waterways. And ever since then, farmers have been fencing off their waterways, their streams, their rivers, their lakes, their harbour. And so this is basically a report saying this rule's worked, that we've got a lot more fenced, but there's still 39% in 2017 that wasn't fenced, so there's still a long way to go.
Yeah, so I can't really tell there. The first bit I read seems to imply that there's been a lot of fencing without planting, but we know around this harbour there's definitely been planting.
The ideal is to have quite a wide strip. The wider the strip, the less pollution gets into the stream.
Yeah.
But then the basic thing is to have the fencing itself so that the animals don't get in the stream, because that's the most direct way in which they can pollute a stream, just by putting their droppings straight into a stream. So.
Yeah, yeah. So now there was another little bit here. In 2017... land use for dairy had a much greater proportion of fenced bank length than for dry stock, 87% compared to 36%. And I've been saying for a while that the bigger the farm, like a dairy farm is quite an intense form of agriculture, so you can make enough money to earn a living off in a much smaller area than a dry stock farm. The consequence of that is when the dairy farm goes to fence off their waterways, they haven't got the same length of waterways as a dry stock farm.
Yep, and also
it's cheaper, is what I'm saying.
And there's been a big push from Fonterra to get it done, because some of their customers have required it as part of their agreement for buying their products.
Right, okay.
Because there's quite an awareness in many consuming countries now of whether products are being produced in a sustainable way.
Yeah.
So many, particularly the big supermarkets in Europe, are pushing it and saying that they want to actually advertise that they've got green credentials and attract customers that way.
Yeah. So that's been successful in a lot of ways, but now, I mean, yeah, the extra length of waterways on a dry stock farm, it's going to require some funding support, I would have to say.
Well, there has been funding support all the way along. The regional council's been paying about a third of the costs, and the farmers have been paying about two thirds. So that's the basis that really got Harbour Care running. I'm not sure what's happened to Harbour Care now. It seemed to have given up, but I'm not sure that you've heard any more.
I've heard things, but I don't know if I've got anything official to say.
No, I haven't either.
Yeah,
I just noticed that their nursery was virtually empty a couple of weeks ago when I looked at it.
Yeah, watch the space, maybe.
Yeah.
We'll find out.
And Harbour Care has been struggling from time to time because the number of people who want work done has gradually declined as they've actually achieved these numbers, and the ones that haven't been fenced, there's still that 13% even amongst the dairy farms that haven't fenced, so they tend to be the people who are quite resistant to doing it and feel that they're losing bits of land that they don't want to lose, or they don't want to pay the two-thirds cost of the fencing, so there's reasons for not doing it.
That hasn't it? I've heard that it's been shown that it's financially beneficial to fence off the waterways.
Yeah, it probably is, because your animals are in a better health, and you don't spread fertilizer, it just goes straight into the waterway.
Yeah, and that's the narrative I've heard around, like when Harbour Care first did, they got council to fence off the council-owned farm in Wainui Reserve, and they were just doing it because it was sound idea for the environment, and then discovered that it was actually made it more economically efficient to run as well. Uh-huh. And you're not getting stock stuck in boggy areas and things like that. Anyway, that's not quite my area of expertise. I just remember people from Harbour Care telling me about this. What else have we got, John, in the State of the Environment report for the Waikato region?
It is quite a lengthy report, but as I just picked out a few things. One of the other things they say is that over 50% of the streams in developed catchments, that's anything except the native bush, scored the worst for the macro invertebrate community index. That's the sort of tiny creatures that live in it.
Yep.
Probably ought to be talking to Bruno about this as well.
He'd be able to tell
us. He understands these things much better.
Tell us
than
what they are and give us a visual picture. Yeah.
So over 88% of the sites in the Waikato were in the worst band for the macro invertebrates, which is not good.
68, not 88.
Sorry, misreading it.
It's still bad, though.
And
that's for E. coli. Sorry, I interrupted. Yeah.
Yep.
So that's just little creatures.
Yep, sorry, 50% in the macro invertebrates and 68% in the E. coli. Yep.
I'm interested in the use of the word developed catchment there. They've described it as developed. We've developed it from native bush. The other word you could use is disturbed. We've disturbed the natural world. Mm-hmm. What do we say about that? John, any conclusions there? Is it getting worse?
Well, it's certainly not good when over half the streams are polluted with either macroinvertebrates not being able to survive or having lots of E. coli in it. E. coli being a bacteria which is a symptom of other things which are problematic with the stream. So that means two-thirds of our Waikato waterways are in a bad state.
Yeah. And would that be resolved by proper riparian planting? Do we know?
Well, that would certainly help. The other problem is just that we have gradually been increasing the stocking rate of cattle, particularly across the land, and the more you put on, the more runoff there is from urine and all the other things that cattle produces.
Yeah. And that's been the advice to farmers over the last couple of decades? or longer?
Yeah, well, as we've just been saying, things like the fencing have improved. So there have been attempts to, and if that hadn't been done, it would be even worse than it is. But despite that, because the numbers of cattle have increased and because, as you say, the gaps between the fences and the streams sometimes are really, sometimes the cattle are right next to a stream virtually.
Yeah.
They're not actually in it, but which is better than being in it, but it's still not good.
Yeah, well, Fred was very scathing of what happened with Plan Change. Well, Plan Change 1, is that the one they called it? Where the regional council, after lots of haggling, ended up putting a rule that you had to have the fence 1 metre away from the stream, and Fred pointed out that that's almost a waste of time. It was, yes, quite scathing.
Yeah, because even on the Wainui Reserve, there is one point where the cattle are within about a metre of the stream, and it's a main cattle race, so there's quite a lot of cattle go through that area.
Yeah, that wouldn't be... you're shifting your cattle race away from the stream. Well, sometimes they've got to cross a stream, though, don't they? Anyway, I'm getting a bit out of depth in terms of any expertise we might have, but those are the stats. On the plus side, the area of land protected by QE2 covenants increased from 4,000 to 15,000 hectare. But that's not really a lot, is it, John, in terms of the overall region?
In relative terms, it's almost quadrupling it. But as you say, in terms of the area of Waikato, it's still pretty small.
I'm trying to look up. 25,000 square kilometres for the Waikato region, or 330,000 hectares.
Of that, 15,000 is not very much.
No, not much. Although, it's also not nothing.
We have got quite a large area of native bush as well, so about a quarter of the Waikato is native bush.
Okay. But as a part, we certainly are intensely farmed around our particular region. Those are the stats there. Land protected by Kawenata. John, can you tell me what that is? Because I don't know.
But it's the Maori, as I understand, it's the Maori equivalent of the QE2 covenants. It's a very similar thing.
So that increased from 903 to 15, or nearly 16,000 hectare. Okay. Do we say hectare or hectares?
I think it depends whether you're French or not. Yeah.
Okay.
Could be hectare.
That's not helpful. what else?
There's also figures on freshwater wetlands. So they say that it's a fraction of what it used to be, which isn't surprising.
A third of the pre-European herbaceous freshwater wetland.
Yep. And similarly, 8% of the freshwater wetlands, including Kaikatea,
pre-human,
is what it represents. So 92% is gone, which again isn't surprising, because in the early colonizers in the late 19th century spent a lot of money digging canals all over the Waikato to drain the wetlands. And you look at any large-scale map and you'll see lots of straight lines, straight blue lines drawn across the map, which represent all the drains that they dug.
And as one of my interviews with Bruno, Bruno David, who used to work for Regional Council, now is one of the people running Workshop Brewery, he said that one of the things that happens when you do that, when you drain the peat, is the peat compresses. And they've got situations now where the drains actually run the wrong way and they have to pump water. So do they have peatlands in the UK, John, in England?
Yeah, there's quite a lot in East Anglia, and they're having similar problems. A similar extent to which they drain them. So there's only very few which are still remnant, and they're mostly nature reserves as they are here.
Did the colonists know that that was happening in the UK? Was that known at that time, that when you drain the peatlands, the drains would end up running the wrong way, and it was...
Probably not, no. I think that's something which we've become aware of in the last 50 years or so.
Okay, yeah. But we still seem to be draining more and more peatland, like it's actually still happening, I've heard. John's looking at his stats now. He's
I'm
going,
not sure.
He's going, don't mind what you've heard, Aaron. I want stats. I want hard stats.
Yeah, because most of them are protected in one way or another, but I wouldn't be surprised if there are some still being drained, but probably relatively minor compared with the 92% that we've already lost.
Yeah, so we do have 18,500 hectares of undrained peatlands, which taonga for iwi provide habitat for threatened flora and fauna and can act as carbon sinks in their natural state. So very important.
So most of it would be that area which is south and west of Thames.
Okay.
So, there's a big area at the sort of south end of the Firth of Thames that has pretty much remained as it was, and it's one of the world-class nature reserves.
Mm. And the other problem we've got over in that Hauraki Plains area is that as the peatland is sinking, the sea level is rising, and we're getting in danger of... is some of that area under...
Yes, it is below sea level.
Below sea level.
And but for the pumps, it would be under the sea, yeah.
Yeah, so at some point, our region has to make the decision, do we forever try to prop up that land as farmland? And I know there's communities who live there and people make their living there. At what point does it become too costly for the rest of us to send our rates over to there to keep propping up an area that's under sea level?
Yep, well, it's a problem not only for peatland and farmland, but also for housing as well, because there's some areas, particularly I think in the Hawke's Bay and in Dunedin, where that question is quite relevant to quite a number of houses as well.
Mm, yes. All right, State of the Environment Report, we're having a look at the key stats. What else have we got? Estuaries were moderately healthy or good at 13 of the 15 sites monitored. I just lost my screen.
Which includes ours, because they list Whangaroa and Firth of Thames and Tairua.
Two sites in poor health. Do you know which one those are, John?
No, they don't say, and I couldn't find it anywhere in the report. Maybe if I searched elsewhere on the Regional Council website, I could find them, but I'm not sure which ones are not in a good state.
So they say 13 of the 15 sites monitored were in good health, however, many indicator taxa and sediment properties were declining over the 2001 to the 2018 period. So taxa, what's that, John? Is that is that like throwing the word taxonomy, like it's some scientific classification system?
Yeah, I think I'd say it was synonymous with species, but it's not quite.
Not quite, but we'll just use species. So indicator species and sediment properties declining from 2001 to 2018, and animals living on the bed of estuaries are particularly sensitive to being smothered by sediment.
Yep, and also sensitive to nutrients as well. So that's one of the other points that they make. And they also mention that carbon dioxide concentrations are up 20% since 1980, which is no surprise because that's what the United Nations keeps telling us.
So carbon dioxide concentrations in what?
Well, it's in the air. I've forgotten where they measured it. I can't remember offhand.
So there's 20% more carbon dioxide in the air over the last 40 years?
Not the last 4 years.
It's 40.
Yes, yep.
Now, if it was the last four, we'd be really in trouble.
Because we did have an organisation called 350.org, which was trying to keep it below 350, and now it's about 100 parts per million above that.
Oh dear.
Yeah, it's not good.
Mm. Okay, so yeah, a mixture of good and bad news, but not really the good news we'd like to see, I think. But credit to the people who are doing positive things, though. We've got to keep reminding ourselves of that. There are people out there working hard on these problems, and they need a bit of credit from time to time, especially the farmers who are spending their own money fencing off waterways so the rest of us can have cleaner harbours and things like that. Are we moving on, John? You're frantically scrolling. What's going on?
I pressed the wrong button on my computer and managed to delete what I was looking at.
Okay. Well, I've still got it on mine. District Council workshops, transport asset management plans. What have we got, John? Is this even interesting?
It's a workshop that's coming up next week on the District Council, and they're looking at what they're going to be spending money on as far as transport goes over the next 3 years, 10 years, so long-term plan stuff.
So a transport asset, is that a road?
Mostly, yes.
A road, a bridge?
Yes.
Things like that, okay.
They do also mention sustainability and wanting to have modal shift, as they call it, so moving from using our cars to using other less carbon intensive ways of getting around.
So they say that's a good idea.
But they don't actually include much about it in their plan. The only things that they include in the plan in that direction is spending money on some railway stations up north. So that's part of the idea to create a commuter service from Auckland out to Pōkeno via Tuako.
It's not helping us here, is it?
No. But in here, they're looking in terms of spending a lot of money on building roads to the south of us. So that's all they sort of building up the population from 3,000 to 12,000, and all the roads they reckon are going to be needed to get that traffic onto the main road, going round pretty much. I think we've talked many times before about that possible road going from roughly Wainui Reserve across to the main road at Mangatawhiri Road.
Yeah, which we hear plans, informal plans are happening in the background, which I'm not going to say in secret, but
most of these things are in secret, that's the problem.
Effectively it is, yeah. So, many things, many thoughts coming through here.
And it also includes things like the $10 million set aside for the widening the bridge on Wainui Road between here and Raglan West.
But that's the one that keeps getting put back. When I first arrived in Raglan, I don't know, at some point anyway, the first time I saw it, I think this year was one year that they promised the bridge would be built. Uh-huh. And it's at least, 6 or 7 years away at the moment?
Well, the date that they had last year was 2029-30. So, yes, 7 years ahead.
There we go. How much of a... Is it a problem? How much do we...
Well, it seems odd to me to have a plan to spend $10 million on that and also to spend $10 million on the bypass. So, what it seems to me an either-or.
So, it actually says... Okay, sorry, I didn't quite pick that up.
They're calling Rangitahi South Road, which they're proposing to spend $10 million on. And my guess is that's going to come from developer contributions from those 9,000 extra people.
So they're hoping behind the scenes that all that will come through and they won't have to put any $10 million into the bridge general ratepayer funds. That'll be it, won't it? Surely, that makes sense.
That makes sense, but it's not what's in last year's plan, but they... as I say, they've got a workshop on it next week, and that may be one of the things that they look at and say, hey, do we need both of these?
One thing we do know is that the Rangitahi properties are selling a lot faster than people are expecting because, of course, we didn't unfortunately anticipate the housing crisis that we're currently in. So I think they'll be getting those developer contributions quite quickly.
Yep, and meanwhile, all that traffic is going to be coming through Raglan West over that single-lane bridge and trying to reach Hamilton by the main streets in Raglan.
Yeah. The thing is, every time we talk about this, we come to the thing that if you build the bridge, then more people will use it. And at the moment, people are kind of avoiding using it, and so you don't actually get the gains you think you're going to get by adding an extra lane.
Yeah, and of course, my argument is that really they ought to be looking at improving the bus service so that people don't have to drive.
They should get rid of the bridge and build a ferry, John. That's what they should do.
And they had a ferry there originally, before 1907.
Let's go back to those times.
Because one of the things they never seem to take into account when they talk about road schemes is that it actually costs everyone, the AA reckons it costs about $5,000 a year to run a car. So if you need two cars in your house because there isn't a bus for the other person in the house to catch when they want to do the odd trip, then you're adding an extra $5,000 onto the cost of running your house. And they never take that into account when they look at schemes. So when they look at public transport schemes, they look at the cost of the buses and the trains and so on. But when they look at road schemes, they don't look at the cost of the cars.
Mm. So if we took $5,000 from every household, how much money would we have? How many households in New Zealand?
Well, there's 5 million people and, what, just over 2 people per household. So probably about, 2 million houses at least.
Times 5,000?
Yes.
What's that, John? Is that 10 billion?
That's a lot more than that. Because we're talking billions, aren't we?
Oh, 100 billion?
Yeah. And okay. That's per year. So.
Okay. Is that enough money to build a really comprehensive, fully subsidised transport system, public transport system throughout the country?
Nobody's ever costed it, but quite likely is.
Okay. And then everyone would have to sell a car. Well, they wouldn't have to, but
yeah,
that's the trade-off. And people might be like, no, I don't want to sell my car. I don't like sharing a car with my wife.
But then it sorts out the problems with pollution and the congestion and things like that. So, yeah.
I just had Dave Smith leering at us through the window there. David Ward Smith, that one. Now, okay, so all right, yeah, too much, John. I can't. It's common sense. It's simple calculations. I don't know where we're going with it.
Because the other thing that's interesting to note is that they are talking about it next week, and it's then going to be part of the long-term plan that we consulted on next April.
Mm, okay. So the next week's that meeting, 17th of July. Okay, going to the Infrastructure Committee meeting, the 5th of July. Extreme Zero Waste. Concern was raised that Extreme Zero Waste is servicing a facility in Tauku that was not covered by the contract with council. That sounds like a surprise. Because yeah. I've heard them talking about extending the contract. They were contracted to do 3 days a week there, and that needed to be extended to 5 because that's actually how much work there was. Yep. Where does that comment come from?
This is in the minutes of the Infrastructure Committee meeting, so it might be worth quizzing Extreme Waste next time you're talking to them and say, is it or isn't it in the contract, and is that why, one of the reasons why there's problems with the Tauku waste collection?
They've definitely been talking about, including in community board meetings, about increasing the contract for that site from 3 to 5 days, 3 to 5 day pickup.
Yeah, because all I've done is quote what it says in the minutes, so it just says it's not covered.
Yeah. I mean, the situation we've got there is that it's a drop-off facility that's not got any staff, and people are taking advantage of that and dumping illegally and creating a mess, and there's also no one there to clean up the mess when the wind blows. So,
and their cameras get vandalised, which again puzzles me because the one in the middle of the airfield supposedly doesn't get vandalised.
I guess you feel a bit more exposed in the airfield. People would see.
It's still a camera that's looking at you.
360. Yeah. Who knows? Maybe it's just one particular individual has decided that they're going to vandalise that one at Tauku. But yeah, it's not very helpful.
One of the other things on the Infrastructure Committee agenda was the connectivity strategy, which is going to go to consultation. So that's the way you can walk and cycle and horse ride around. The main thing that's missing from it at the moment is a map, so it's going to be interesting to see what map they come up with.
The other thing missing is a budget. Let's be honest, there's a whole lot of lines going to go on maps there of things that aren't going to get built.
Well, that ought to be in the transport asset management plan that we were just talking about.
Yeah, true. All right. Next, John?
Well, a figure that I hadn't seen before is the number of boulders that they put down on the wharf. So they're talking about 1,400 tonnes of basalt boulders that came from around the wind farm.
Oh. Is that wind farm area full of basalt boulders?
Yeah, well, the whole of that wind farm area is part of the basalt eruption of the Ōketi basalts that happened just a bit over 2 million years ago.
So all those boulders that appear to be about the right size for the job, do they just appear like that underground somewhere?
Well, they're not underground. Quite a lot of them landed, are lying on the top. Yeah.
They came through the air that size, like 2 foot wide boulders, or between 1 foot and 2 foot wide boulders, just plop down in Tauku.
That's my understanding of it, yeah.
Okay, all right. That's nice and convenient. Anything else you got?
The other thing that I spotted was that the Western Walkway, they've got a photograph showing that it's very close to the seagrass and commenting that the seagrass has actually grown and expanded 8 metres in recent times, which maybe relates back to what we were talking about the environment and the harbour being in a good condition.
Yeah, the seagrass has been coming back quite consistently for quite a while now because of the riparian management. Yeah, it is a very good sign. Were you worried that they were going to step on its toes by putting the Western Walkway in?
Well, I hadn't realised until I saw that map that the walkway was actually coming quite a bit out from the current seawall and covering quite a large part of that beach, almost up to where the seagrass is.
Okay. The next thing you've got is from a policy subcommittee meeting. Freedom Camping, they're removing the prohibition from Stewart Street.
Well, this is a proposal, yeah.
And staff are proposing this?
Yes.
Removing the prohibition from Stewart Street and applying a restriction instead. Okay,
So essentially they're saying you'll be able to freedom camp around the old school and that area on Stewart Street, but you have to be out by eight in the morning You can't be there earlier than five in the evening, so it would be available for parking the rest of the time.
Why that spot?
They haven't explained why. My guess is that there aren't any houses there, so they feel that they presume that the church and the old school won't be too disturbed by having people there overnight.
So it would just be on one side of the road?
They talk about Stewart Street. They don't say which side of the road, so I'm guessing they mean both sides of the road.
Well, there's houses on the other side.
Yeah, the new ones they just built.
Yeah, and the old ones that are still there.
Yeah.
And the old pensioner flats, whatever they're called now.
When this comes out to consultation, which should be in a month or two's time, I think, have a look out for that one if you're interested and have your comments, say whether it's good or bad.
Yeah, so residents of Stewart Street, look out for that one. We'll keep you informed, but I know these things pass people by quite a lot, so yeah, let your neighbours know if you're concerned about that. What about this? Some freedom camping near the water treatment ponds?
Yep, so
prohibited area.
Yeah, so as well as allowing camping on Stewart Street, they're also restricting it in a couple of other areas, and one is near the sewage ponds and the other one is in the Wainui Bush Park car park. So those are a couple of relatively small new areas that they're proposing to ban freedom camping.
But this is basically the game of whack-a-mole where you limit areas and so they go somewhere else, and then you limit that area and so they go somewhere else. And I know that Dennis Amor, the chair of the community board, actually wants to create some spaces where they can go to try and contain the problem.
Well, this is all coming out for consultation. So these are the thoughts that so far staff have had from... there has already been some consultation on it, so they're not just working on their own ideas, but what they've heard from other people.
Okay. Well, yeah, if you're concerned, and I know people are, keep an eye out. You get your chance to submit. But it might need to be more than... If you don't like it on your street, it's going to need to be more than just one person submitting, because that would not be... I reckon that won't be considered to be much of an objection. Would that be right, John? You need most of your street to speak up?
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Should we have a little break? Oh, sorry.
We have got a new council, effectively, since last October, so I'm not quite sure. They seem rather more receptive to what people say than the previous one, but I'm not sure how much it has changed.
Okay. You want to talk about steamships?
There's all sorts of things. We could talk about road safety as well. I rather rudely called out to you, be careful, last time when I saw you crossing Bow Street. Sorry about that.
Was road safety on your mind? I think I'm fine.
I'd actually just seen the ambulance racing by with its lights flashing, so maybe that was what in my mind. But anyway, it showed a rather disregard for people crossing the road, which is a perfectly reasonable thing to do in Bow Street. So sorry about that.
Shall we have a quick little break and get ourselves organised into this?
Okay.
Kia ora whangaroa. This is a community funk announcement.
Get past the people, get past the hitman.
Hey, got the morning show with Aaron, and we're just getting ourselves organised here. Oh, the crash analysis system, this is what we're looking at. Is every dot a crash, John, on this map of Aotearoa?
So every crash that's reported to the police ends up on it.
Say that again, I hadn't put your mic up.
Every crash that's reported to the police ends up on a map that's produced for the Waka Kotahi, and you can look in detail at every street, and if you click on each dot, it will tell you when the crash was and how severe it was, whether it was just a minor crash or whether there were injuries or severe injuries or worse still. So it gives an idea. Not surprisingly, most of the dots are on the main road.
Yes.
But there are quite a lot of other dots around as well. For example, in 2022, the last year, there was a motorcycle crash near East Street on the main road.
Yeah.
Which resulted in injuries.
Serious crash, 2022. Okay, yeah. I found that dot. That's a red dot. There's a red dot down at the junction of Wallace Street and Bow Street.
Oh, there's that red dots all over the place.
But I don't know what. That's a non-injury crash.
They've got a code system as well, but maybe we ought to put a link on our Facebook page and people can play around with it and see where the problems are and maybe take more care in those places.
There was
Bow Street has three red dots down it, which seem to me to relate to my flippant and not very good remark that you ought to be careful when you're crossing the street.
Maybe you should. I see that there was a serious crash in the year 2000 down the end of Greenslade Road, and I'm wondering, what were they doing? Like, it's at the point where you can see it's a dead end.
I don't know. And if you click on the three dots on this map, you also, when you've got the particular crash up, it also shows you a table down the bottom, which shows you what the lighting conditions were like, what the speed limit is, what vehicles or were involved, whether they were cars or trucks or whatever. It shows you a whole load of detail, which it seems to me ought to be one of the things that the community board ought to be looking at from time to time to see just where improvements are needed. Otherwise, we tend to get people coming along to the community board and saying, oh, there's I see a problem down my area. And quite often that means that money's spent on areas which aren't particularly dangerous, and the map shows the areas which are.
So are these all these from the from 2000? I can't find any that are pre-2000.
No, they're in the last 23 years. I think that was probably when they started recording the system.
I'm just looking at the Greenslade Road State Highway 23 intersection, which is an area that we talk about as it feels dangerous to people, and there are crashes around the bend there. Non-injury crashes, non-injury minor crash.
Yeah, because if you
minor
look at
crash,
if you look at nearly all the road junctions along State Highway 23, there are crashes at them, and I'm not sure that Greenslade is significantly worse than the others.
No, I think probably because it feels hair-raising, people are actually a little bit more careful.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, like down Bow Street seems to have the most density of crashes.
Well, the safest part of the main road is where all the bends are up on the divvy, so people obviously take more care there than the rest of the road.
Yeah, yeah, no, and that's the thing. Like that's, I don't know what it's really called, but I'm going to call it modern traffic planning. In terms of safety, thinks about creating all the signals along the road that tell people to slow down. So if you make a wide road with lots of space and you think that's going to be safe, people drive really fast and they relax and they stop looking out. And so it doesn't really solve the problem. So the divvy is one of those things that's giving you signals to be careful.
Yep. And if you can keep turning corners, you probably need to be fairly wide awake so you don't doze off. So probably quite a number of these crashes are actually where people have dozed off. But I've still not seen an explanation as to why the concrete truck fell off the road on what wasn't a very tight bend between here and Tiuku a few months ago.
You think sleep?
Well, it seems to be one of the options. Because, as I say, it's not particularly tight bend, so if a concrete truck was going to come off the road, I would have thought it would be on a tighter bend.
You know, the only thing I'm getting out of this is that the busier the road, the more crashes there are. I'm not actually seeing any like crazy hot spots. It's just where the car, where there's intersections and where it's busy, you get more crashes.
Yep, that's a fairly good summary of that map.
Yeah, so it feels like if people talk about the hot spots or the death spots, do they say death spot? I don't know, but yeah, it doesn't.
because you need to look at a busier road for that, because we've only still got about 6,000 vehicles a day on the main road, which in terms of somewhere like State Highway 1 is probably only a third or a quarter of the traffic on that.
All right, I'm going to go to Hamilton. I also noticed that Government Road, which is along the top of Government Road, it feels quite... look at Hamilton. Death trap. Yeah. You're along the top of Government...
Avoid Hamilton if you want to survive.
Yeah. Along the top of Government Road, it feels quite narrow and like there's not enough room for the parked cars and everything, but there's actually been no crashes along there. Uh-huh. And again, it's one of those ones that tell you you just instinctively want to go easy.
Yeah, it's maybe a message that we ought to be designing our roads so that they look dangerous, so that people take more care.
Well, I tell you what, the Dinsdale roundabout is a bad place or a good place, depending on your point of view, with crashes. Some of those dots are not on the road too. Are they in the service station? Okay, you could spend hours looking at this, and this is not very exciting radio, but what do we know, John? There's no real hotspots in Raglan is what I'm surmising from that, but I'm not an expert.
Yeah, well, I think the three serious crashes down Bow Street are maybe ones that we need to be thinking about, because generally vehicles aren't going fast down Bow Street. The situation's maybe been improved recently by making the crossings rather more obvious. The one that you were using when I was being rude to you was... one of those that you should have been able to use safely.
Yeah, yeah, and without being abused either. Yes. Yes. Now, we were going to talk some history, but we've left ourselves like 5 minutes. This tends to happen. But looking back to 1923, 100 years ago, and Whangaroa News in 1923 was dominated by transport issues, just like we're talking about today. The more they change, the more they stay the same.
Yeah, it seems to be one of the things that gets into the news, whereas they weren't doing housing surveys or anything like that in those days. So maybe to that extent, they were the transport was rather more obvious to write about. So that's my guess as to why transport may well have been one of their topics rather than any of the other things that we tend to talk about these days.
But also in a recently colonised country, there was probably a big... Building transport networks was probably a big deal for the colonists anyway.
Yeah, well, in terms of Raglan, I think we've discussed before that it gradually moved from being virtually isolated apart from the occasional ship calling to when the wars took place about, 5 years or so after Raglan was first settled, they started... building the road to give the troops access to the Waikato War, the invasion of the Waikato.
Right.
And the road after that gradually got into a bad state because the government wasn't interested in maintaining it anymore. So there were lots of complaints about the bridges falling apart and it being boggy and everything. And then I think we've also mentioned that by the beginning of the 20th century, they started putting gravel on that road and got that done in the 1920s.
That's on State Highway 23.
Yep. So it was then a gravel road, and it only took about 3 hours to get to Hamilton.
But people did want... only 3 hours. People did want a railway from Raglan through to Hamilton, didn't they?
Yep. Well, that
talked
was,
about it for decades.
Yes. they started talking about it soon after settlement, and it was only... finally squashed in the 1920s, well, a century ago.
Yeah, 1923 became the year the railway plan was defeated and plans for road upgrades began. But when they started talking about having a railway to Raglan, there must have been only a couple of hundred people living in town.
Well, they had great ideas that it was going to become the port for the West Coast, connecting with Sydney.
Oh, wow.
So the idea was that Auckland's harbour at Waitemata was on the wrong side and... it was a shorter journey from here to Sydney than it was from the Waitemata Harbour to Sydney.
They had no idea how big ships were going to get, did they?
Well, they had no idea how tricky the bar was either, because over the years there have been, all the West Coast bars, because the bars seem to be much worse on the West Coast than the East Coast, and they've all been problems for shipping. Ours probably less than some others, because I was reading about the bar on the South Taranaki port of Partia, And almost every year they had one or two ships that stranded on it, and quite often ended up being wrecks.
So,
the Hokitika was similarly treacherous for ships.
But that was the only way to get around the country for large parts of the country. Uh-huh. Okay, so that's when roads became the big deal, and we've been and the council, whatever our council is, whether it's Raglan County Council or Waikato District Council, building roads has been the reason that feels like the main reason for their existence.
Well, it was initially the reason for their existence because they were set up as highways boards. So we had highway boards for Raglan and for Whangaroa and for Karioi and all the
lots of little ones.
Small districts each had their highway board. And their main aim originally was to actually build the roads and actually have something other than bush to whack your way through. So,
yeah.
So that was their original purpose, because people were buying land and found that they couldn't actually access the land that they'd bought. So the settlers were coming and they were keen to get onto these boards and create roads and raised rates which paid for the roads. But the rates were very much smaller in those days, and the cost of building the roads was very much smaller because they were much more primitive roads than we look for today.
Even though, you've told me that there was a lot of complaining about the cost, nonetheless, of the rate.
Yeah, well, people have always grumbled about rates and taxes, and things haven't changed. So, yeah, and if you want things, then you need to pay rates and taxes for them. And there's then a debate as to who pays those rates and taxes, whether it should be the richer people or whether it should be equally distributed or what it should be.
Yeah, and that kind of misses the point about how, well, getting involved in that kind of small-scale squabbling misses the larger point of how beneficial or how essential it is to the running of the whole country. And we found that out with Cyclone Gabrielle. Like, we lost State Highway 23, and we had a detour that added an extra hour, and that seemed to be a hugely big deal. And you wouldn't have thought so. Like, coming up to that, I would have said, okay, well, we'll just deal with that when the time comes. But it seemed to be super...
Well, we were going back a century. As I say, it took about 3 hours a century ago, and it then took 2 hours to get to Hamilton, roughly.
Yeah, but before that, 10 hours on a stagecoach. And now we can't bear it going from 45 minutes to an hour and 45, and so people were taking shortcuts down Old Mountain Road and scaring people's kids and having crashes and because they were so desperate to get to Raglan on time.
But looking back to 1923, it had one thing that we've got in common now, which is that people were fairly apathetic when it came to local elections. So in May's local elections, only two ridings were contested. The Karioi riding was won by a Charles Swan, so that's the Swan family that's still down at Ruapuki.
Yeah.
They were up against the Vernons, another local farming family. And over in Whangaroa riding, Thomas Parker won over C.W. Ralph and W.J. Lusty. The Lusty name, I think, has still been around quite a bit. I'm not sure the others have so much.
I have heard it.
Though there is Parker's Road down Waitatuna Valley Road, so yeah, these names still have some resonance.
Can we... I just want to add a little bit more about transport. I've just seen this bit you've got here. Like, we're over time, but Raglan's average traffic in 1923 is counted about 2 kilometres from the town, was around 11 local cars a day and 17 others. So that's 28 cars a day using State Highway 23.
Yep, and it's increased a lot even recently. So you look back at the...
Doubled in summer, John.
Yes, you look back at the average traffic 20 years ago, it's about half what we've got today.
Right. Something about Raglan played rugby against Carfair in 1908 and 1913, but then in many other years...
Yeah, the problem of actually getting a rugby team down to Carfair to play, the road down there is pretty bad today, but it was even worse in those days.
Yeah, it is all about the roads. It really is. It's our whole culture and system and infrastructure, it's all based on the roads.
Yep.
And getting things from A to B, and if we can't do that, we're a profoundly different culture, profoundly different civilization.
But as I say, we need alternatives because it could be cheaper and it could be far better for the environment. So that's one of the things to consider in the election that we've got coming up later this year.
Mm, indeed. All right, John, time to go, I think. You're on the air tonight, 6 o'clock?
6 o'clock, yes.
Okay, and you probably don't know what you're going to do yet, do you?
As usual.
Yeah, right, okay. Just stay tuned at 6 and see what John does. All right, thanks for coming in, John. End of the show for the day. Hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back again tomorrow morning. I'm hoping to talk to the Environment Centre tomorrow.